America Looks Abroad. This is the 54th in a series of broadcasts presented by the staff members of the Foreign Policy Association, a nonpartisan organization which offers accurate information on world affairs. Today's subject is Axis prospects in the Balkans. Mr. David H. Popper, research associate of the Foreign Policy Association, is the speaker. Mr. Popper.
Thank you. War has now been raging for 6 weeks in the wild and mountainous territory around the Greek and Albanian border. Today, the astounding Greek triumph is climaxed by news that the fascist forces are abandoning their remaining bases in southern Albania, at Porto Edda and Argiro Castron, and retiring toward the north, while the Italians are shaking up their high command. These Greek successes have had an electrifying effect on all of non-Nazi Europe. We hear that morale in Greece, Turkey, Egypt, and Palestine has risen appreciably. The diplomatic offensive of the Axis in Romania, Bulgaria, and Yugoslavia has come to an abrupt halt. Everywhere, Britain's supporters are heartened. And in London, the public is already beginning to demand a knockout blow against Italy. The British government itself has given indirect sanction to this idea. Lord Woolton, the British Minister for Food, while explaining the new rationing regulations, declared the other day that every available British ship would be diverted to the Mediterranean for what he called a coming great offensive against Italy. We might conclude from these facts that Britain was on the threshold of a major success in the Balkans and the Eastern Mediterranean. Without knowledge of all the elements in the situation, we can't definitely say that this is the case. But we do know enough to draw up a tentative balance sheet of the prospects in the Mediterranean area. Consider first the factors favorable to Britain. Foremost among these stands the Greek campaign itself, an entirely unforeseen development. 6 weeks ago, any military expert would have told you that the Greek army was not well trained, that it was a second-rate force, deficient in equipment, that the country was restive under the iron dictatorship of General Metaxas. The Italians themselves believed these things. They launched their attack with insufficient preparation, quite certain that Greek resistance would collapse or Greek unity break before a show of fascist force. We were all of us wrong. The spirit of Greek patriotism proved stronger than the forces of division and defeatism within the country. Even though the Italians bombed Greek cities and ports and lowered civilian morale, the army was able to complete its mobilization. From that point on, the battle was a problem in strategy and tactics. The Italians had sent the wrong kind of army to the mountainous border. It was highly mechanized and motorized, a road-bound army, which was attacked and outflanked by Greek mountain troops descending from the peaks surrounding the highways. Bad weather and mud hindered the Italian advance and reduced the striking power of Italian aviation. The Greeks, acting with surprising skill, were careful not to press forward too quickly and weaken their lines of communication. As the situation stands today, the Greek army has occupied a long strip of Albanian territory, extending from the Yugoslav frontier to the sea and averaging more than 25 miles in depth. The Italians have been sending fresh troops to Albania, but the passage from Italy has been hampered by Royal Air Force attacks on the only remaining Albanian ports, Durazzo and Valona, which are inadequately equipped at best, and probably by the activity of British submarines in the lower Adriatic. The Italian aim just now appears to be to establish a defensive line along the Shkumbi River, which divides Albania into two almost equal parts. The principal Italian bases would then become the capital, Tirana, as well as Elbasan and Durazzo. Now, this is not to state that the Italians have yet lost half of Albania. Barring unexpected complications, it should take the Greeks a long time to push the Italians out of the coastal mountains in the southern portion of Albania. Under their new leadership, the Italian forces may be expected to unleash a counterstroke at any time. Until that stroke is delivered, it would be wise to withhold judgment on the true scope of the Greek victories. We must remember that Greek manpower and supplies are not inexhaustible, that British support on land and in the air have thus far been severely limited, and that the Italians retain air superiority over all this sector. So much, then, for the first factor in Britain's favor, the Greek advance. Equally important are the British victories on the sea. The torpedo attack by the fleet air arm on the Italian battleships at Taranto, and the naval engagement off Sardinia a few days later. Conflicting claims and counterclaims make it difficult to state precisely just how much damage was done to the Italian fleet in these encounters. But it is clear, nevertheless, that the British Navy holds the advantage in the waters around Italy. That advantage was immeasurably strengthened by the occupation of Ceuta Bay in Crete, which brings British planes and cruisers 400 miles closer to the Italian bases than they were in Egypt. And the advantage will become still greater if the Italian Dodecanese Islands off the Turkish coast should run out of food, fuel, and other supplies, as they are said to be doing, and surrender to the British. The third factor favorable to Britain, and perhaps the most important of all, is the condition of the people in Italy itself. A recent report by a government agricultural economist in Washington has cast new light on Italian living standards and emphasized the hardships which Italians are undergoing to carry on this war. Italy depends on foreign supplies for many of the most vital raw materials and foodstuffs. Out of about 24 million tons of merchandise imported into Italy in 1938, over 20 million, or about 84%, reached Italy by sea, and about 80% of these shipborne imports passed through the Strait of Gibraltar, with another 5% coming through the Suez Canal, and a similar proportion through the Dardanelles. You can see, therefore, that the British blockade of Italy is crushing in its long-time effect. Ordinarily, Italy receives through Gibraltar and Suez 80% of its imports of cotton, 90% of its wool imports, all of its rubber and jute, 70% of its cereal grain imports, 2/3 of its fats and oil imports, and all of its foreign purchases of coffee and meats. The experts say that the Italian cotton reserves should be almost gone by the end of this year, and that supplies of wool and jute should not last much longer, and that rubber is extremely scarce. There is an acute shortage of petroleum. In fact, the Italian drive into Egypt may have been undertaken not only for strategic purposes, but also to replenish Italy's stocks of cotton and food. Nothing important has been heard from that front for several weeks, and it seems likely that the fascist advance has been hindered by the pressure on Italian supply lines across the Mediterranean and the desert, exerted by British ships and British planes. Nor is this the whole story of Italian privation. Within 2 weeks of Italy's entry into the war, new food restrictions were applied, and they have been increasing in severity ever since. There are now 4 meatless days a week. Sugar, fats, and oils are very scarce, and coffee is lacking. And even wheat is so short that bread flour is adulterated. Last Monday, the consumption of spaghetti, flour, and rice was restricted. On Thursday, an agreement to increase Italian food shipment to Germany was disclosed. Since August 1939, food prices have increased enormously. 33% before Italy entered the war, and an undisclosed amount since that time. The fourth factor favoring the British in the Mediterranean is the indirect effect of the campaign against Italy. The old adage, "nothing succeeds like success," seems pretty thoroughly demonstrated in modern war. Last week, the British were able to announce the conclusion of a credits agreement for trade between Spain and Britain. A sign that Britain does not expect General Franco to permit a German attack on Gibraltar through his territory, not in the immediate future. The Turks, too, have made a new economic agreement with the British. This will tend to tighten the bonds between the two countries and to reduce somewhat Turkish dependence on the German market. The Bulgarians, backed by Russia, have made it quite plain that they do not intend to join the Axis-Japan Pact and become subsidiary members of Germany's new order, as have Hungary, Romania, and Slovakia. Thus, countries which were slowly falling into the Axis orbit have been able to stave off the final steps in the process. So, all in all, the war in the East has been going relatively well for Britain. But it would be wrong to overemphasize what may prove to be purely temporary gains. The basic factors which made the Eastern Mediterranean situation extremely critical for Britain remain largely unaltered. In the first place, it would be a mistake to believe that Italy has been knocked out. The British appear to have sufficient naval strength in the Mediterranean, but they lack men and airplanes, and probably supplies. Their numerical inferiority has made it impossible for them to send a real expeditionary force to Greece, where it might have helped to disorganize the Italian retreat and finish the campaign quickly. The same inferiority has made it impossible to assume the offensive against Marshal Graziani's troops marching on Egypt. And as long as the British Isles stand in deadly peril of invasion or destruction from the air, it is not likely that reinforcements can be supplied on the scale needed. Even if the Italians were driven completely out of Albania and Egypt, Italy would be far from defeated. Like everyone else, the Italians will fight better at home than abroad. They may undergo starvation and punishment from the sea and from the air with great fortitude if they are convinced that they are defending their native land. More than this, the Germans cannot afford to let Italy or the fascist regime collapse. There is no doubt that the Italians would be loath to see German forces on Italian territory, or even in Albania, for that would constitute an admission that the southern end of the Axis is only a junior partner in the new order. And German policy in southern and eastern Europe has thus far been to avoid direct military measures in order to exploit peacefully the raw material production of the region and to carry on hostilities against the British Isles without any distraction from the rear. But the psychological effect of an Italian collapse would be so great, and the strategic advantage of it to Britain so clear, that neither Italy's scruples nor Germany's convenience would stand in the way of the necessary Nazi military movements. Basically, the ultimate decision on the war in this area depends, then, on Germany's move in the Balkans. We cannot tear aside the veil and gaze into the future, but we can see that the anarchy created by the Iron Guard revolt in Romania has given the Germans an opportunity to send additional troops into that country and to tighten their grip on its oil and wheat resources. We can see that German pressure may split Yugoslavia at any time, either by encouraging the Croat minority to revolt or by egging on hot-headed Hungarian and Bulgarian nationalists who want slices of territory which Yugoslavia took from them in the last war. Large-scale German military intervention in this area is unlikely before the spring, for the Balkan winter is hard on armies. A German campaign would move southward, through Yugoslav or Bulgarian territory, toward the Mediterranean Sea. Once the German military machine wins a foothold there, it may be depended upon to make things difficult for the British in the neighborhood of Suez. Greek and British victories, then, deserve our admiration, but their significance should not be exaggerated. Temporarily, the Axis has been stopped in the Balkans and the Mediterranean. The question remains, can Britain press home an offensive against the weaker flank of the Mediterranean? Can Britain do it when its home territory is under devastating attack by Germany? Britain means to fight on, that we know. Britain will fight on for its own safety and its system of social and political organization, hoping that with American aid, it can win a decision in the end.
Mr. David H. Popper, research associate of the Foreign Policy Association, was today's speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. If you would like a free copy of this talk, address your request to the Foreign Policy Association, 22 East 38th Street, New York, or in care of the station to which you are listening. The Foreign Policy Association is a nonpartisan organization open to all who are interested in foreign policy. It offers accurate information on current world happenings. In the world of today, foreign affairs are your affairs. We invite you to tune in next Sunday to hear another speaker in the America Looks Abroad series. This is the National Broadcasting Company.